This is comma real 4.
To describe an operation is on the dropping zone, which has been chosen by the people of the resistance. They had to have clearance from trees and pylons with lines or anything of that sort. They would put on the ground three lights in a big, very big triangle, one at the apex and the two at the base. And within that very big triangle, the pilot would aim his drop of the containers. Sometimes they were slightly out, you couldn't help that, the wind or something would change it. Therefore, the people had to be out there before the curfew. The curfew in the darkening days in winter especially was very early, it was at sunset. So these poor people had to go out, and they might have a wait of 5 or 6 hours, waiting hidden away if possible. The order had been, first of all, no talking, because in the dark voices do go a long way. Secondly, no smoking, because a little red tip of a cigarette was visible so far away they could have been seen. So these poor Frenchmen, and if you think of them, sitting there, not doing anything, and not being able to discuss politics, they were absolutely at their wit's end, I think, by the time they heard the aircraft engine floating around. They would rush on to the field. One man was in charge of a lamp, very small lamps they were, just pocket lamps, and he had to signal the letter of the day, and the pilot would signal the letter of the day from the aircraft to show it was the right place. Then the pilot would go around and only drop at the second operation. And the people would rush after he'd left to try and get the containers. These containers were like huge metal cigars, circular and long though, weighing about 400 pounds each. So the men had to have leather straps or very, very strong straps. To begin with, there were only four men to a container, and then afterwards they managed to put six men to a container, getting the straps underneath the container to lift it and then to carry it and hide it. They tried to get it as far away as the dropping zone as possible in case that had been noticed and some enemy would come along, or even an intruder who might give them away. There were no cars to be used during the curfew time, so they couldn't go away by car. They didn't have any horses. Horses had been requisitioned, so they had to fall back on carts drawn by working cows who used to do the work in the fields. And these ladies did not like working overtime, that is to say, working at night. So they plodded at their two speeds, dead slow and stop. It was hard work getting them, but it would have been harder work still to go carrying these terribly heavy things very far. So they did go patiently, hoping daylight wouldn't come until they'd hidden the containers.
Now, what happened after the March-April period?
March-April period meant that May we were listening, organising the listening on the radio for the messages all the time. The men could, of course, not maintain that. It fell to the people who were in the homes, whether it was grandma or children or everyone contributed, to try and listen in. The main times were still 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock broadcast from the BBC. Then we had a message which meant listening to the broadcast 24 hours a day. So we shared it, the boss and I. We installed a little set in the hay up in a loft outside the farm, and we listened in that way. The other people by then had a message, sort of a standby message. We were told that it might happen any time, you must listen in you might hear your message. Get yourselves ready. Put the clothes you will wear for work when you go away, and make all arrangements for those who stay at home, looking after the animals and that they have food and all that sort of thing. So all that was taken care of. When finally, as you may know, it was slightly delayed because of bad weather, because of storms. When finally the message came through that the Armada had sailed forth, there was terrific rejoicing, because the night before they had heard their messages, and the little crowd who was coming up to our village, by then I was living in Castelnau too, they came up during the night, and we had been up all the time also, cleaning up what weapons we'd had. We didn't have many, but still quite a bunch, and they had been hidden under the beehives. We thought the bees would be good and protect them. But this was, of course, out of doors, so we had, first of all, put a lot of soft soap on them so that they would not rust. And then they were in the metal containers. We hoped for the best. Well, we had to get hold of the man himself, the beekeeper, to move his little hives a bit. We got all the stuff out, took it into the kitchen, and spent the night cleaning these weapons. All the rags possible were used up. This was happening all over the country, I must admit. And then by morning the others had turned up, and we had allocated them to various houses of the people in the village we knew they could. And they went out, despite the fact that they'd been coming up to the village and only had about 5 hours sleep. They went out as soon as possible to blow up the railways, to blow up bridges and such like, to get trees knocked down on roads so as to block the roads. The bigger the tree, the better, and that sort of work. They came back then early afternoon, and they all went and had a good sleep, because the next night they were going to continue that sort of work. Well, that was the actual D-Day, when the ones were coming, the other ones were coming in on Normandy.
What happened next?
Well, we continued like that for 2 or 3 days, and by then the near ones had gone. We received messages, couriers came along to say what the other people had done all round, how they had behaved, that they had known miliciens, that is the milice, had been arrested and all that. We had a few, and not having a prisoner or anything, they were locked up. The three of them were locked up in the little church, it's a tiny chapel, and they were locked up in then. The weather was perfectly all right. It was nice and warm for them. They had paillasses on the ground, and they were receiving food. So we felt quite straight there. Nothing on our conscience. We were giving them what they needed. Then others had done more or less the same sort of thing. But there was quite a lot of coming and going to this small village, and this was noticed by Germans who were staying in a not far off, bigger, much bigger village called La Romue, L.A., La Romue. There they had asked, apparently, some Mont-de-Marsan or some other Air Force aircraft, and we noticed one day one was coming circling above us, which was a bad sign. And then we just waited. We knew something would happen, and it was. The next morning, our advance little group scouts came rushing back to tell us that the Germans were on the way. They were on the main road. I was sent away then with the doctor to, just with my set, that's all I had, overall, and why I don't know, but I put a clean hanky and a clean pair of socks in one pocket. I had a little money in the other pocket, and off I went with my set and my briefcase, which naturally had all the requirements for sending off a message. We walked off down the hill and up through the fields, trying to get to somewhere else. He knew the people around, so he took me to another farm. We walked about 5-6 kilometres, and there I was able to quickly encode a message and send it at the right time. We could hear the shooting in the village, and finally we heard an awful bang, and that was the ammunition dump being blown up. So we realised that they must have left the village by then, and the doctor decided to go back to Condor to find out if there were any news. We borrowed the little car from the people where we were staying, the farmer, and he came with us, dropped us at the entrance of Condor, and eventually we did find that the boss was there with the other people who were escaped from La Castelnau. And we joined up together then and went off. People gave us cars, and we went off afar, because they were glad to get rid of us, because we brought danger to them, of course. But we went much further on by car. All of the tanks were filled, luckily, and then stopped somewhere else, which we knew was part of another group of our people. And there we were able to have a meal and spend the night.
What happened next?
Next we amalgamated. All of them seemed to amalgamate, forming up a much bigger group, of course. I stayed on in the house so as to be able to continue to send off my messages and ask for instructions and all that. It went very well. Hilaire used to come back every night too. My assistant was there too, so finally we decided to separate. Not both work, though it helped at the time because there was a lot of traffic. And Hilaire said, yes, we're going to go and join what finally became the bataillons, the battalion as they called it. So we joined them. We had these people to look after us. We had no trouble from that. And there were no more Germans in the region. Our men were fighting them in various spots. There was one battle at Ayr, there was another at Estaing. There were various battles, and during that time also the SS Das Reich was leaving the Pyrenees apart too. So they came up, and our men therefore decided after a time, we won't stay here, we'll go somewhere else. And once more they used to go out for 2 or 3 days and come back to HQ, and others would go out. They sort of met about 20-30 kilometres further and passed on, and they really didn't. But by then we had several French officers, colonel rank, major rank and such like, and they knew how to deal with an infantry battle, so they could do it. Our men were very good, I must admit. We did lose some, but we must not forget that all the French do have some military training in their youth, so it was all right.
What happened next?
Next, we cleared the region of enemy troops, must admit. It was all clear. And they asked for permission to continue pursue these troops, which was done. By then, we went in a car. That was the only way to do it. My assistant and myself still separated, so if one was caught, the other would be able to carry on. We carried on various places, following at a safe distance, I must admit, until after this battle of Estaing, which was a bit more serious. There we joined up together in a place called Aveyron-Verrel, and it was decided that some people were going to come back to England and give a report on the thing. There was a New Zealand pilot from the RAF who'd escaped. There was a Dane. There was a Dutchman. We sent, Hilaire sent back Colette, the English courier. From there they had to go over the Pyrenees in that way. No, my assistant came on, so that wasn't, there was another one. It must have been a Frenchman who came back, the other one. Anyhow, they got back to England all right. And we continued still. We noticed that the Germans were going towards the town of Toulouse. There were still some battles on the way, but finally we reached a hillock outside Toulouse, and by then the men had they called them provisionally liberated, cars and lorries and things. Well, other words, it would be borrowed, these things, and they were all in there. There were well over 1,000 men, and there were two little staff cars, one in front, which was our little one. We had picked up two Jeds, one an Englishman, one an American. They were radio operators of two Jedburgh teams, and they sat at the back, and along we went until the French commandant came up. He was riding a motorcycle, and he came up alongside the car, asked us to stop. He'd stopped the whole column and explained that as we were on the point of entering the town of Toulouse, he would very much like the colonel who was driving to put a Union Jack on the car to indicate that it was a friendly car, you see. And he brought out of his pocket a Union Jack his wife had made out of parachute material, dyeing the right colour sort of thing. So we put that on the spoke of this little open car, and we went off slowly. The Tiny, as we called him, because he was only 6'5", the American, said, "Oh, if only Old Glory was there," and pulled it off his sleeve and put it onto the we stuck it onto the windscreen. So we entered the town of Toulouse, which was an important, it's the fourth biggest town of France, with the two flags and with all our men behind us.
What happened next?
We were put into barracks, which the men did not care for, but they still went out in skirmishes. I was stuck there. All radio operators were stuck there. We had to wait for them to come back at night to be able to contact home again and give them the news. Our men went out harassing the Germans who were leaving.
What happened to you personally?
Personally, I was stuck in the barracks, you see, working on the radio all the time. We stayed there a short while. Then Hilaire, on the second day, went down to see the authorities, the Commissaire de la République and all that, and met the authorities who were civil authorities who were taking over the town. I also met him, and they accepted our presence at the time. And later on, there was this big to-do between General de Gaulle and Hilaire. But that is written in General de Gaulle's own letter, own book.
What was this to-do?
Well, the general did not approve of foreign troops and gave us 24 hours to get out. I saw the colonel when the boss, when he came back immediately to the house and told me to send this message. I prepared a message and encoded it to be sent, and at the same time was asked to write a letter in French for the general to explain that we had to obey the orders and we were awaiting the reply of the telegram I'd sent and would be excused if we could not get away and within the 24-hour limit. We never heard another thing. We stayed for over 48 and never heard anything. But the man in Bordeaux had the same get out of here in 24 hours order.
How did Hilaire react to those orders from de Gaulle?
Very, very upset. He was called a mercenary, and that upset him above all.
What happened to you next?
Well, our men left Toulouse, duly re-equipped, uniform, kitted up in every way, and they went on pursuing the enemy to beyond Toulouse to the east. They went to Sète, they came back, and they went up further then. Hilaire decided it was about time, as we had some money left, to go back on our tracks and see if there was anyone we should help of the people who had helped us. Luckily we did this, because we found when we got there at the actual farm where I had jumped. The parents had both been sent to concentration camp, leaving the girls of 14 and 16 and a half, 17, alone with an elderly grandmother, without money and not being able to do much, of course, because they hadn't got the strength since father had been sent away. And therefore we were very glad to be able to give them some money to feed them. They'd been on their own from September 43 until August 44, poor things. Others we were able to help slightly too, but it was material things they needed on top of everything, equipment, clothes and that, which wasn't so easy to give them straight away. We had to wait till we got back to England for that.
What happened to you next?
We were given an instruction to go to Toulouse and Bordeaux, the two airports rather, to collect some pieces. It was mainly Bordeaux we found what we wanted, to collect certain bits of pieces, equipment of German aircraft to bring them back to England. This was done by sending out an aircraft which landed at Mérignac, and yes, they wanted these things that we'd found. Then we went from there, we went as far as Lyon. From Lyon we got to Paris, and from Paris we got back to Farnborough.
What date would that have been?
25th of September, 44.
You mentioned earlier what you described as Jedburgh teams. What did you mean by that?
Jedburgh teams were created under the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. Other people call them the Donovan boys. They were called Jedburgh here. These teams were a mixture of one American with a Frenchman or an Englishman, mixed ones, and a radio operator, either English, French or American. Our first ones came to us, I think it was April 44, but I'd have to check that. The first team, half French, half American, who worked very well. They were stationed, they were sent down to the Pyrenees, that's where they worked mainly. Then others came out later on. Three came out as late as August 44. I was able to be at that drop to watch them. It was rather funny seeing them come in. And then still more, when we got settled to Toulouse, some more joined us. They remained. I don't know when they came back to England. It was just by that time, my assistant had already been sent back to England on an aircraft from Toulouse, and we came back, as I mentioned to you, on the 25th of September, 44. The two of us, simply.
We were talking earlier about narrow escapes that you had. Could you describe your narrow escapes?
One of them happened at the end of June 44, because, of course, I didn't stay with Hilaire all the time, but we didn't trust, we couldn't really send couriers on the road anymore. It was too dangerous for them. So he got himself a little car with the excuse, all the papers which went with the car. He was an inspector of tobacco growing. And like that, he got the petrol to come along, and he used to come unexpectedly sometimes to find out what the latest news had been from London. But he turned up one afternoon in June, late June it was by then, 27th, 28th, I don't know, it was quite late, and told me to come straight away to the car because the Germans were getting near the spot. Well, I did say I must take my set and my documents, which he agreed to, so we rushed up to the room, picked these up, threw them in the back of the car and went off. He'd been told that the Germans were coming from two roads, on the east and the west, so we took one due south, hoping to escape them. But we hadn't gone 15 kilometres when we came face to face with just one personnel carrier, but still. So we were stopped, and told to get out of the car. Then they put us in the ditch. It was quite low, with two soldiers in between us. Both had a pistol, one in my back, one in Hilaire's back. We were back to back, and these two were back to back too. And therefore, if the man's elbow, I gathered, had moved, or something like that, the other, who felt his elbow on his body, on his back, would have shot Hilaire, you see. So there we were, kept waiting, standing, not knowing why, until I realized that he was the Feldwebel, the adjutant or whatever it is, I don't know the exact rank in English, was telling somebody on the radio that he'd stopped a tobacco inspector and a woman. The woman had a district nurse card on her, and what was he to do with them? They're both dressed civilian clothes, but they were very quiet, they were terribly worried looking. So that was that, you see. I don't know what he heard in return, because it was on a pad. Then waited longer still, and my perspiration was coming down, the flies were sticking into the perspiration. I couldn't move, because if we'd moved they would have shot immediately, you see. Therefore, waiting still, waiting, and then the crackle came up again, they were being called back, and this time something or other was said to them, and he came back to us, said Achtung to us both, and then we tried to straighten up, if that was what he wanted, you see. He told them two soldiers to go away. So those two got out of our way, which was a great, and we turned halfway round to face the Feldwebel then, but in a civilian way, faced him, and he told us get in the car, which we did at once, and as he was checking, he suddenly asked me what was in the case which had been thrown on the back, which of course was my radio set. And I opened it. I knelt on the seat and opened it for him, you see, to show him that it was perfectly all right. I showed it to him. He asked me what it was, and I said, a radio, which in German means a radio cell, as well as X-ray. In view of the fact that I had a district nurse thing, he thought it was an X-ray set. And let us get out. So we got out very fast. The engine was already running.
Any other narrow escapes that you had?
Sometimes in the train, when they were checking everything, and they would ask awkward questions, but nothing as bad as that. That was the worst.
What type of awkward questions?
Well, awkward questions where one was travelling. This was a very nice new card, and things like that, checking not only for me, but the others on the train as well, and that all. Well, they'd counted more on having somebody telling them something than anything else. The new people would be very careful of how they were dressed and what they had when they were going on a journey. So they were waiting for a sign if they had got somebody on the spot.